WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
College graduates looking for work in a tight labor market.
Some economists say businesses are now replacing entry-level jobs with artificial intelligence.
How many applications have you sent out?
Anywhere from like 10 to 20.
What's the response been like?
I haven't had enough experience, and that's of course challenging because I can't get any experience without a job.
Hey Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Stick around for a breakdown of the top stories of the day in the Chicago area later in this episode. But first, once upon a time, college was the biggest ticket to a professional career. Get a degree, land a job, and move up, right? But for a growing number of workers who followed that advice, the recent job market has been quite shaky. Layoffs are aplenty. AI is on an upswing, and people with a bachelor's or a master's, they're struggling to get hired or stay hired. So joining me now in studio is In the Loop intern Brooke Miller. She is a senior at Northwestern. Hey, Brooke.
Hi, Sasha.
Good to see you. I had to pull you in here, girl. I'm so sorry. But, you know, when we think about it, your big day, your graduation day, it's coming up, right? Just a matter of months?
Yeah, I'm graduating in June.
Yes. And so you will then be stepping out into the working world full time, or at least that's the hope, right?
Yeah. So I have a little bit of an interesting path that I'm going to take.
Tell me about that.
I played soccer at Northwestern for 4 years, so right now I'm hoping to play abroad for the next year.
Okay, so you'll be delayed trying to jump into the job market here in the United
States. Exactly, yeah.
And so how are you feeling about that?
Yeah, so I'm a little bit worried just because I will be gone for a year. I don't have hopes that the job market will get better in a year. I'll also say I major in journalism. The journalism jobs market is a little competitive from what I've heard.
Ooh, you don't say, Brooke.
From what I've heard from people in Medill. I would say also I'm a black woman. We just heard that that type of person doesn't have the easiest way into the job market, especially with a college degree.
Yeah, we'll get more into that in the episode. But yeah, it's not looking good for college educated black women.
They've
got the steepest drop.
Exactly.
Employment.
And I've heard one of my mentors in the past has actually told me, also alluding to the fact that I am a black woman, that I need to go to grad school because it's super competitive and that will help me directly with getting a job.
Well, despite all the doom and gloom and learning about, you know, this drop in employment for college educated people, is there anything keeping you hopeful about your future, Brooke?
Yeah, I would say right now I'm from Naperville, Illinois. So a lot of my friends are moving back to the city after they graduate, and they all have job prospects right now.
In Chicago.
So that's making me hopeful that something will open up when I get back.
All right. Well, lots to get into there. So let's dive in. Thank you for stopping by, Brooke.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
So the big questions here, what changed? Why does a credential that used to open doors seem to matter less today? At the table was Noam Scheiber, who's a New York Times reporter based in Evanston. He's also author of the upcoming book, Mutiny, The Rise and Revolt of the College-Educated Working Class, that comes out in April. And Sarah Rand joined us. She's a communications consultant who has firsthand experience with this very issue. To get started, I asked Noam to help us understand what's driving this trend. Here he is.
It's a bit of a mystery. We've just never seen long-term unemployment this high when the overall employment rate is actually not too bad. The unemployment rate's about 4.4%. It's not, you know, historically fantastic, but it's not terrible. And yet we've seen long-term unemployment, which generally means 6 months or longer, really tick up in the last year or two, and especially among people with college degrees. And so it's been a bit of a mystery for economists. I think automation is always looming, and for decades, obviously, that was something that affected blue-collar workers, and college degree was supposed to insulate you from automation trends. And certainly we've seen with the rise of generative AI that more jobs are automatable. But the trend actually precedes Gen AI. I think it's something that we've really seen for the past 10, 15 years. And I think a lot of it is kind of pre-AI automation. So you have spreadsheets and you have accounting software and you have HR software. And these are all jobs that college-educated people have done for many decades. And as the software has gotten more sophisticated over the past few decades, it just, you know, little by little, it started to kind of erode some of the demand for college-educated people that has historically been very strong. So I think it's a kind of gradual automation story that's now been supercharged by AI.
And you talked a little bit there about some of the recent trends we've been seeing on the job reports each month and that long-term unemployment still ticking upward. Talk about the comparison for folks without degrees.
Yeah, so folks without degrees still have a higher rate of long-term unemployment than folks with degrees, but that has the gap has really been narrowing. So I looked at some data going back to the late 90s, and the difference between folks with degrees and without degrees is the smallest it's been for the past 30 years. So again,
so everyone's on a almost level playing field
exactly.
at this point.
It's really close. For many years over the past few decades, the long-term unemployed or the people with college degrees were long-term unemployed at about half the rate of everyone else. And now it's more like 70%, three quarters of the rate. So it's really starting to narrow. And it's just not the case anymore that a degree insulates you from this.
Let's bring you in, Sarah. Yes. What's been your recent experience with this job market?
Yes, it's been...
As you shake your head.
It's been interesting, for sure. And no, a lot of what you're saying resonates for sure. Last spring, my husband and I found ourselves laid off from our jobs within a few weeks of each other.
Both of you.
Both of us, which was pretty shocking and something we were not expecting. We had felt insulated. We had college degrees, myself a master's. We had stable employment for almost 20 years. And suddenly the fields we were in felt under attack. I worked in academia. I've also worked in nonprofit and research institutions. These are sectors of our workforce that are facing real challenges from the current administration. And it's felt different.
How so?
In this economy. It feels like the job market is very impenetrable. It feels like there's a lot of AI involved. It's seeing job postings with over 1,000 applicants, submitting job applications that feel like they go into a black hole, going through job interview processes that can drag on for months and require really extensive interviewing and requirement to do tasks. It's a really taxing experience.
A lot of people applying for these jobs too, right?
Yes.
Some of these job postings are seeing, 1,000 people apply?
Yeah.
And so how do you stand out among 1,000 people?
Yes.
And it sounds like your degree alone is not going to help.
That's right.
So talk to us about some of the changes that your family's had to make, I imagine, to accommodate.
It's been a low spend year, is one way we're thinking about it. We've had to really think about how we're adjusting our family economics. The caregiver that we had hired for our kids, we had to reduce her hours. We got rid of a car and simplified our finances. And it's some of the spending that we would have done that we're not able to. We had been planning to do a home renovation project that is very much on the table or off the table right now. You know, there are causes that we would like to contribute more to, especially in this time of great need. And we're not able to do that in the same way. And just really scrutinizing all of our expenses on a daily basis in a way that we are surprised to have to make those kinds of choices.
Yeah. And one caveat that you make throughout an op-ed that you recently wrote in the Sun-Times, sharing your personal story is, you know, this is new to my husband and I.
That's right.
But we're well aware that this has been a reality for others for quite some time.
Yes. It feels like, this is a new experience for us, for college-educated folks, and, you know, seeing what the lower class experience this fall with decline of SNAP benefits. It's a new kind of instability, and it's just made us realize how fragile our ecosystem is, how precarious our social safety net is. Relying on employer-provided health care is challenging when right. then you don't have an employer to provide that health care. So it feels like a precarious system.
And Noam, you've, of course, been following this for quite some time. So Sarah's story sounds quite familiar, I'm sure.
Yeah, unfortunately, really familiar. Everything from the job application process, which as you guys said, is feels almost like an arms race. You know, it's because of the use of the AI, employers are not personally vetting applications. And so workers feel like they then have to use AI to increase their odds of getting an application through the vetter,
right.
which then increases the number of applications and causes employers to use AI more. And then it just kind of keeps cycles that way. I think, you know, if you step back, one advantage that people who have a college degree have traditionally had is standing out in an application process. You know, I know how to write a good cover letter. I know how to write a good resume. I have good references. I can really talk up my work. But now that everything is being vetted by algorithms, it kind of flattens those advantages and you just don't stand out the way that you did before. So I think that's really causing a lot of stress for college grads who sort of knew how to navigate this old world, this kind of human interaction world, and in this algorithmically mediated world. It's just not sure where your advantage lies.
Yeah.
I think that's led to a lot of confusion.
And as we, you know, we think about who's most impacted here, you know, recent reporting shows college educated Black women. They are seeing a very steep drop in employment, and it's been pretty steady over the past year, and more than other groups. So, you know, more than other women, more than Black men. What do you think is contributing to this, Noam?
Yeah, I mean, there are a handful of things, but we do know that Black women with college degrees are disproportionately hired by the government and especially the federal government.
Yes.
And so the freezing
they're overrepresented in the federal
exactly.
labor force.
So the freezing of hiring and the aggressive cutting of federal government jobs, I think, has really disproportionately hurt that group.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's been it's a group that kind of, when the economy turns, tends to be hit harder, faster. And when you layer on this reduction in government jobs in particular, it's going to have this disproportionate impact, unfortunately.
So how are you approaching the job market differently now, Sarah? Given all of these factors, what does your search look like? Are you doing what Noam just described and using AI to help beef up your cover letter and your resume to catch the eye of these employers?
Great question. And a little bit of that to try and game the system when I can. But I've pivoted. And that's what this moment has really required. I did the submitting jobs into the black hole, found that not very productive. I've worked my network as much as I can, and I do have a great network here in Chicago that's been very supportive. But I've pivoted to working for myself. I've hired myself. I am running my own consulting business, doing strategic communications.
Congrats.
My husband also is doing the same, working in food systems and building food businesses. And I guess we've sort of stepped back from the traditional job search process and are approaching it in a very different way.
Because that in itself is a full-time job,
yes.
is it not?
No question.
Applying for jobs, it's like literally you wake up at 9 and,
yep,
and you almost have to like
day.
Get dressed and get to the computer and just sit there.
Sarah and I were actually talking about this earlier, even more so than usual, because what we're finding is a lot of employers are actually having candidates do work that they need
yes.
done.
Oh, really?
Write a program, write a memo, write a report. I've heard of lawyers looking for jobs where they're asked to write legal briefs and contracts. I mean,
only to eventually possibly tell you that you don't have
right.
the job.
No, typically to tell you that you don't have the job. This is
wow.
just part of the application process. And we're finding that employers are using it to get free labor, essentially.
Imagine
so
a world where you would get paid for just right. being
yes,
part of the interview
just
process.
Just being an interviewee. That's
that
right.
That would be lovely.
Yeah. So it's been a time of creativity and resilience and Noam and I were talking earlier that for a lot of organizations that I work with, it can be really hard to commit to a full-time role, an FTE of an employee. So offering myself, being able to support them on a contract basis is much more easier for them to justify that expense. And it's been a great experience to work with clients across Chicago and nationally and maintain my professional muscle and make connections and continue to do the work that I love to do.
So a question for you both. Do you think that college is still a good investment despite the rising cost to get a degree these days? Noam, you want to go first?
Yeah, I think it can be. I think the difference between today and, say, 20, 30 years ago is 30 years ago, just getting a degree, you didn't have to think too much about it beyond that. You know, just having that degree gave you this sort of wage premium. It just set you on this path for success in your career. Now there's just so much more differentiation. You have to think about what degree, what school, what industry, what moment. And if those things don't align, it can actually be a not a great investment.
Right.
In my book, I write about a group of people who got degrees in video game design. And this has just been an explosive major across the United States over the past 20 years or so.
Wow.
And that's great when, you know, there are a lot of video game companies hiring and there's a huge demand for video games, but it's a highly cyclical industry. And in the past few years, it's been cutting jobs at a really rapid clip. And that's just not a very good investment for you in today's market. So you have to ask a lot more questions today than you did a generation ago.
And what's the psychological impact here, Sarah? Just trying to job seek right now. How do you keep yourself motivated?
Well, again,
I mean, you've made a
it
pivot.
It was the pivot. Was
before that, though.
Before that, you know, I think we are consistently hopeful and looking for opportunities where we can apply our skills and be productive. And it just sort of takes a resilience and approach that, you know, got to keep doing every day to try and find a good opportunity. And it just takes that consistent optimism.
Noam, what do you think this all means for the future of the middle class?
It's a great question. I think that the way we think about class is changing. I think it used to be, you know, when I graduated from college in 1998, which is a very long time ago, probably, you know, arguably the best or one of the best years in history to graduate from college. You know, people, my cohort, thought of themselves as just on this glide path to a professional career or to a management career. You didn't really think twice about it. And I think now when people graduate, they have to think like, okay, like you have to kind of think about every detail of the process. How, you know, what is my entry level job going to be? What's the next step look like? What's the step after that look like? And I think they're increasingly finding that there isn't this sort of glide path to a professional career. And it's making them think that they are less sort of part of this elect or this sort of special caste, and they're just workers like anyone else, you know? And I think that kind of worker consciousness is in some ways good, sort of eroding these differences that college people used to see in themselves and other people. Instead of thinking, oh, I'm part of this special group, now you're starting to think, well, maybe I'm just part of this kind of bigger group of workers and my interests are actually pretty similar to workers in vastly different industries. You know, I remember talking to a group of doctors a few years ago while the auto workers were on strike. And doctors are a group of people who've very rarely unionized, and they are a part, you know, they're a very special cast of workers. And they were telling me how they thought of themselves as auto workers on some level. And one told me that he even took his kids to a UAW picket line because he wanted them to see what it meant to kind of walk a picket line and be a worker. So I think we're seeing these kind of barriers eroded between different fields and different professions in a way that might be positive on some level.
And so I want to wrap this conversation by echoing your piece on suntimes.com, Sarah. Just what's your message to government officials? What are they missing in this conversation?
That's a great question. I think at the basics, we really need economic transparency. Last summer, we saw Trump fire the Bureau of Labor Statistics commissioner after weak job numbers came out. I feel like data sources are being eroded. And just at the basics, we need to have the numbers. We need to know what's happening. We need to see the reality. And I think this will just give us a clear picture so we can hopefully put in place some improvements for the job force and the job market.
Economic transparency.
Yes.
Yeah. We'll leave it there. Sarah Rand is a communications consultant firsthand experience with this issue. And Noam Scheiber is a New York Times reporter based in Evanston. He's also author of the upcoming book, Mutiny, The Rise and Revolt of the College-Educated Working Class, that comes out in April. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Great to be here. Thanks for having us.
WBEZ's nonprofit spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, now it's time to get into the top local stories of the day. At the table to help me break them down, Claire Lane, WBEZ's Morning Edition anchor, and Nader Issa, Chicago Sun-Times reporter and assistant editor. We kick things off with the Chicago Bears' disappointing loss against the LA Rams over the weekend. They're out for the season. Boo! Here's Claire.
What a way to go out. I mean, people had sort of written off what were fourth and four, Nader. And then the catch to end all catches with Caleb connecting in the end zone. Mm. And we thought just for a moment, we're going to do it again. And then we couldn't quite get it done. But it was a really fun season. Chicago gets really amped up, as we know, here in the newsroom, so much camaraderie across the city.
Yes.
In suburbs, too. I was in Rockford last weekend visiting family and everybody was wearing Bears gear. And this was at a funeral.
So was I. I'm the biggest bandwagoner ever. I had a scarf on. I had a hat, a hoodie.
All the sporting goods stores, like the Lions are full of people. They've got stuff in their hands. They're selling out, they're restocking. But I mean, despite everything they've done, I somehow was still shocked by the longest 14-yard touchdown I've ever seen in my life.
And
I mean, it's good to know that the Bears have a coach and have a quarterback. I think that's the biggest thing we needed to see this year. But
yeah, let's give them their flowers, shall we? I mean, Caleb Williams, I think they're out for the season, but I think more and more he proved he's the guy.
He is.
He's the one.
We've been waiting. How many quarterbacks have the Bears drafted now in the first round? You know, Mitch Trubisky, Justin Fields, even before that, you know, the big trade for Jay Cutler. And all this time we've been waiting. Let's see. Do we have a franchise quarterback? And this is probably the first time in my life where I've actually felt confident going into an offseason that they do. Mm-hmm. So, and this was the most fun sports season, I would say, of my life. And it's really something that captivated Chicago, like you guys said.
Yeah, and a lot of praise I've been seeing for Ben Johnson as well, you know, as a coach. I was just, you know, listening to commentators like Michael Strahan just talk about, you know, maybe he should get coach of the year, you know, so that's big praise.
Well, and Chicago doesn't buy into every talking head. You know, we are kind of skeptical sports fans. We're very funny sports fans, but the city connected with him. I mean, that was true with even just the Wiener Circle doing those like weekly, you know, nods to him to get the fans involved in it. And it really took some shape. I mean, what ticket sales for a Bears game on Sunday were at an all-time high.
Oh, it was ridiculous.
So people, and these are working-class people in a lot of cases, spending their hard-earned dollars to support this team, and they really believe in Caleb. And he seems optimistic, which, too, is important, looking ahead already to next season. He was at the Blackhawk games last night. You know, just that kind of showing up for this city really goes a long way.
Yeah, and they were doing all of this in the freezing cold, right? And the entire weekend was cold. I was out there for a little bit, and it wasn't pretty. So I don't know how these men suit up for 3+ hours
getting hit,
and the snow was falling at the same time. But we're expecting the coldest temperatures yet this weekend.
Yeah, right? We won't have the Bears or the thought of a victory to warm us anymore, sadly.
Yeah.
But we're bracing for a very cold week.
Single digits.
Yeah, we're in the single digits now. National Weather Service actually issued an excessive cold risk warning for this morning. So it's really the wind chills. If we're anywhere upwards of 10 miles per hour with the wind, it's going to feel about 10 degrees colder. That's a good way to look at it.
Ouch.
So 15 degrees below with the wind chill. And then we are expected to have some snow. A little icing on the cake here for that is winter in Chicago.
Great.
Tonight and into tomorrow. So could be slick if
I'm
you're
excited.
Commuting. But then as you mentioned, Sasha, because you do know quite a bit about winter weather.
Was that a Canadian dig?
Maybe. And the temperatures could dip to 10 degrees below zero. And that'll be the legitimate temperature by this weekend. So Friday, I think we're supposed to have a high of 2. So, Nader,
that's
this is
low.
When your Chicago Bears how to gear up to avoid the cold, hot takes.
It works for all cold, not just Bears games. Yeah.
Oh, boy. All right. Well, something else that happened over the weekend. Kamala Harris was here. She made an appearance in Chicago for a Martin Luther King Jr. event. What should we know, Claire?
Yeah, this was the annual Interfaith Breakfast. This was the 40th annual Interfaith Breakfast that's held in Chicago, reflecting on Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's impact here in the city and across the country. You know, it's sort of an opportunity for politicians, community leaders to come forward and speak on, you know, behalf of his impact here in the city. But also, you know, as some people running for various U.S. Senate seats were speaking. But Kamala was in the House reflecting on his impact on her and her leadership. And she actually said that she visited the site of King's assassination the day before coming here, or 2 days before. Mm. And what she really, we felt like was most interesting at WBEZ, she sort of asked everyone to think about what Dr. King would say or what he would see if he's looking at America right now. And the room sort of just released a collective,
yes.
Mm-hmm. And she went on to say that she believes he would see that people today are sick and tired of being sick and tired.
Yeah, that was my favorite quote from the event. Very powerful. Very, very powerful.
Indeed.
Also on the weekend, Nader, protesters were rallying. This was on Martin Luther King Jr. Day. So yesterday, they were marking also the first anniversary of President Donald Trump 2.0 and his policies.
Yeah, this isn't about the actual protest, but just fun fact, it was equally freezing cold last year on Inauguration Day. And so it sort of has come full circle in the
yes.
past year. But yeah, hundreds of people gathered outside of Water Tower mm-hmm. yesterday, representing about 60 organizations. They rallied, they marched to Trump Tower. They're protesting the Trump administration's immigration policies, also their intervention in Venezuela, the war in Gaza, a lot of different things, sort of a slew of issues that folks feel connected to mm-hmm. and on the first anniversary of President Trump's inauguration,
yeah.
the second one.
Yeah. And also relatedly, I mean, Cardinal Blaise Supich, he was among some cardinals who are criticizing Trump's foreign policy.
Yeah, Supich and a couple other cardinals in New York and New Jersey, so three of the most prominent Catholic leaders in the United States, they wrote a statement yesterday that criticized Trump. It didn't name him in specific, but mm-hmm. it basically said the policies of this country are becoming too aggressive, they're harming people, and it was meant to echo the Pope's address a few weeks ago that basically, same thing, without naming Donald Trump, really criticized and went at the direction of the country and its effect on the world.
Yeah, they said, quote, "Our country's moral role in confronting evil around the world, sustaining the right to life and human dignity, and supporting religious liberty are all under examination." Claire, let's pivot now to the first Chicago Midway Blitz trial, right? That begins today, and it revolves around, surprise, surprise, Border Patrol Chief Greg Bovino. What's the story?
So jury selection starts today. This is in the case of Juan Espinosa Martinez, who is facing one murder-for-hire count for allegedly putting a bounty on U.S. Border Patrol Commander Greg Bovino. So at least 30 others have been charged with non-immigration-related crimes tied to Operation Midway Blitz, which, if we can believe it or not, started last fall.
Right.
And so far, charges have been dropped against 14 of those defendants. But this trial, Martinez's case, is the first among them to go to jury selection. So we'll see what comes of it today. We'll have an update, certainly, during All Things Considered after 3.
And let's talk City Hall news, Claire, because Mayor Johnson's administration's exploring this idea of buying back Chicago's parking meters.
Yeah, this is interesting because Chicago loves to talk about it.
Yeah.
And what's happening is a window has opened to essentially seize back what could be a valuable asset from private investors, the parking meters. They were sold in 2008 by then Mayor Richard M. Daley in a deal that was supposed to last 75 years. So the city now has to consider whether to borrow billions of dollars to buy out the remaining amount of years on that parking meter deal. I think it's 57 years remaining. And again, Chicagoans have lots of mixed feelings about this.
I know you have thoughts, Nader, because a lot of people hate this. And you know what strikes me is that it's actually now, and this is kind of embarrassing, it's being considered a cautionary tale for other cities.
Like, yeah, it is.
This is what not to do.
Yeah, I mean, people in Chicago, a lot of people felt that almost immediately. And now this has been the example of bad city deals. But yeah, it was a 75-year deal. The city, to help fill a budget gap that year, they got $1.15 billion. That's a pretty sizable chunk of change. Mm-hmm. But then within a few years, the investors already recoup that money and more, and they keep profiting. And there are really tough pieces of this deal.
Sure.
Like when the parking meters are out of service, the city has to then pay the investors to make them whole. There are just so many bad elements to this. The city had to settle for $15.5 million a few years ago mm-hmm. for a former Mayor Lori Lightfoot sort of scheme during the pandemic when a lot of people weren't parking. And $15.5 million felt like a win for the city to only have to pay that much. And so it remains to be seen whether the city actually goes through and tries to purchase back the rights to these meters, which could take $2, $3 billion. And a lot of borrowing, like Claire said, or they could try to renegotiate some of the details in the deal in this opening.
Well, what else are you watching out for, Claire? Why don't you tell us about this long COVID app?
Yeah, there's a new study out from Northwestern Medicine that essentially found patients who showed improvements with long COVID also experienced more up and down recovery patterns, and they were able to track this through an app. The study's senior author says a team of researchers took a look at over 63 people over 3 months, just tracking their neurological symptoms. Mm-hmm. And then they distinguished between patients whose manifestations improved and those who did not. But what was surprising was patients who improved had that more of that up and down. They eventually got better, but it took sort of a lot of trial and error and time.
Mm. Well, this doesn't happen every day, Nader, but it looks like a Frank Lloyd Wright home is up for sale. There's kind of a catch.
There are a couple catches. This home is 123 years old. It's in Austin on the west side. Beautiful home. The asking price is $350,000. That's from Fannie Mae. They put it up after a foreclosure recently on the home. But it's been suffering for quite a while, and it needs $2 million in restoration. And so if you're thinking you can pony up the $350,000 to own a Frank Lloyd Wright house, you're going to have to times it by quite a bit in order to actually be able to live in the home.
Yeah, and I'm curious, as part of the generation that, you know, where we've seen and reported on home ownership getting just further out of reach for us, does that sound like a good deal to you?
Not to me personally.
Me neither.
I don't think it's something I'm going to be able to put up for, but I mean, if you have the money and are able to restore Frank Lloyd Wright house and live in it.
Then amazing.
Yeah, that's great for you.
All right, WBEZ's Claire Lane and Nader Issa from the Chicago Sun-Times. Thanks for listening to In the Loop. I'm your host, Sasha Ann Simons. Join me here every weekday for in-depth coverage of Chicago news and culture. Let's talk again soon.